So we'll begin with the short mantra, Guru Brahma. Mantra to the Guru. Qualities of a bhakta, a real bhakta, and it's in the context of, in the beginning of the chapter, Arjuna asked, who's better, the ones who see you everywhere in the world, it's called Vishvarupa Upasana, to see God everywhere in the world. That was the end of the 11th chapter. It teaches a type of meditation where you feel, it's just a feeling, that this whole world is kind of like the body of God. It's not knowledge, but you try to feel like that, that wherever you look. Because there's two types of meditation that's taught in the Gita besides Karma Yoga. One is called Vibhuti Upasana, where the meditation consists of trying to, whenever you see anything beautiful in the world, a sunrise, the smile of a child, a beautiful painting, wherever there's something magnificent, something awe-inspiring, in that thing you feel that radiance, that beauty, is just a little infinitesimal part of the infinite beauty and glory of the Supreme Being. That's called Vibhuti Upasana. You see it in the individual things and you try that thing takes your mind to God. The mind has to become God-orientated, turned towards the Supreme Reality. And this is a practice that you do through an effort. But there's even a more difficult one that you have to graduate to, which is instead of seeing each individual thing, you graduate to what's called Vishvarupa. Vishva means the universe. Rupa means form. That you try to see God in the form of the whole universe. Everywhere you look, it's a manifestation of God. That's more difficult, no doubt. And that's how the 11th chapter ends. So in the beginning of the 12th chapter, Arjuna asks Krishna, those people who worship you in your form of the whole universe, that means with form, and those people who worship you with no form at all, who's the better yogi? So Krishna answers that it's better that you try to worship me with form. It's very difficult to worship me in my true nature with no form. So then he begins to describe that the first type of yogi who sees God everywhere in the universe. But then, starting in 13, he begins the description of that type of yogi, that devotee, that bhakta, the real renunciate, who sees the true self, which has no form at all. It's a contradiction. How can you see something that has no form? Leave it alone. That person is able to see that reality which is formless consciousness. So when Shankara introduces that 13th shloka, he says in the introduction, you can follow here if you want, that he says, here, assuming the distinction between the self and God, that there's a distinction between me and God is the whole universe, assuming this distinction, yoga, or the concentration of the mind on the all-pervasive God, that you see God as pervading everything everywhere, has been praised. Krishna said, this is what we should do. This is the beginning of yoga. Also has been praised the performance of works, that we must do works. The whole Gita is not to give up works. Nowhere in the Gita does it teach renunciation of all works. The whole Gita is about doing works. It's not a renunciate text. He tells Arjuna in the very beginning, Utishta Arjuna, Yujasva, enter into the battle. If you try to withdraw and go sit in a cave somewhere, you'll be just a hypocrite, because you'll take that same dirty mind that you have right now and you'll bring it into the cave. I have a friend who, at about the time that I went to India, he went to India, and he went up into the Himalayas immediately, and he learned very good Hindi, and he met a guru. His name was Nantin Baba. Nantin means baby, baby Baba. Because when this Baba was just a little child, the Babas adopted him and they raised him in the forest, and he became very well known up in the Kuman near Almora. And of course, he only spoke Hindi. And my friend said, I don't want any guru that can speak English. If they speak English, they're already no good. So I'm going to find the Hindi-speaking guru. So he found Nantin Baba. And Nantin Baba said, and he went to him, he says, I want you to teach me the truth. So Nantin Baba says, you're not prepared for the truth. You're going to have to do 12 years of tapas. What kind of tapas, Nantin Baba? I'm going to take you to a cave, very remote cave in the Kuman, where there are tigers and wild animals and boars, snakes and scorpions. I'm going to put you in that cave, and I'm going to give you a stick. Do you ever see this stick where it's like a T? And these yogis, they sit and they put their arm on it. And that's how you're going to sleep. You can't lay down. You have to sleep sitting up. And you're going to eat just one meal a day. And I'm going to give you a mantra with a mala. And you're going to sit there for many hours every day doing your japa. You're going to have to prepare your own food. You're going to live alone. And if you can do this for 12 years, I will teach you the supreme teaching. So since this Nantin Baba was such a famous guy, he had thousands of disciples, my friend thought, I'm going to go with this. So sure enough, he went to the cave. He grew his hair long, jetta, down to his ankles. And he was in there for 6 years. He did this thing for 6 years. At the end of 6 years, he told me all he could think about was sex and yogurt. He couldn't do his mantra anymore. It was just sex and yogurt. So he gave up the whole thing. He went to Varanasi. He found some girlfriend, and that was the end of his cave dwelling. Because if you're not ready for it, those old habits, they'll come up and it'll rip you. You'll just be a hypocrite. You can't do it. So the whole teaching of the Gita is not to give up activities, but to learn how to do all of your actions in such a way that they don't become a bondage to you. There's a secret way, the secret of karma, how to make karma into yoga, So you'll be freed from the bondage of karma. That's the essential teaching of the Gita. How even while you're doing actions, engaged in actions, Krishna says, karmani abhi pravritto api, even though engaged in actions, nakim chit karomi, I do nothing. Guna guneshu anavartante, the gunas are moving against the gunas, but I do nothing. Karmani akarma yaha pashet, he who sees no action in the action, sa buddhiman, he is a wise man, not merely one who is sitting doing nothing. Because the guy who thinks I'm sitting doing nothing, you know what he's doing? Plenty. He's breathing. He's thinking. He's scratching his nose. You can't stop. As long as you're ignorant, you can't stop doing actions for a moment. So the teaching of the Gita is not to try to stop doing actions in your ignorance. If you try to stop and you say, I do, the actual verse in the Gita, maybe some of you are familiar with it, it says, he who sees in the action no action, and he who sees action in inaction, that by merely sitting doing nothing, that's an action. You're doing something. What are you doing? I'm doing nothing. That's something. He who sees no action is action, and he who sees action is no action, he is wise amongst men. So it's not a question of stopping doing action. So a sannyasi doesn't mean that you stop doing actions. It's that in your mind you've renounced every action. Manasa sannyasa. That's the sannyasa of the Gita. Not giving up actions and sitting still and not doing anything. That's no sannyasa at all. The real sannyasa is to realize I never did anything, I'm not doing anything now, I never will do anything. Why? I am Satchitananda Swarupa. I am unchanging, immortal bliss. That's the way to put an end. That's called Naishkarmiya, the attainment of actionlessness. Shankaracharya had a disciple. He wrote a book by the name of Naishkarmiya Siddhi, the perfection of actionlessness. How to really be free from all actions. The Gita tells us the secret of this. It's a big study. It would be nice if we could all have a Gita workshop that lasted, let's say, a whole summer, because it's a big book and you can't just take one chapter or even a portion like I'm taking now and think that you understand the Gita. The Gita is a whole text. In fact, the Gita shouldn't be written as read as though it were a novel where you read it from the first chapter to the end, and then there's an actual way to read the Gita. The Gita starts really in the 16th chapter. The first chapter of the Gita is the 16th chapter, where the very beginning of the sadhana begins, where he talks about there are two types of people in this world, Arjuna. Those who are daivi, divine heritage, and those who are asuri, they are of demonic heritage. What is this about? That's the very beginning of the sadhana. Before that, you can't even get to karma yoga, which is the third chapter. So there's a sequence in which the Gita has to be understood. And you can't just take one shloka out of context. In one place, Krishna says to Arjuna, karmani eva adhikaraste, your qualification is only for action. So some people think the Gita teaches karma. There's another place it says, by bhakti alone you will come to me. Oh, the Gita only teaches bhakti. In another place it says, there is nothing as purifying as jnana. Oh, the Gita teaches jnana is the height. So how to understand the whole Gita, that how to make the chaos. When you read this, there's so many contradictory things seemingly. But when it's understood properly, the Gita becomes a cosmos, a coherent teaching that right from the very beginning, the very lowest steps of sadhana, right up to the final thing where I am that supreme reality, right up to that. It's called the steps to self-realization. There is a sadhana that has to be undertaken. So now, what I'm talking about here, this bhakta, this renunciate, this sannyasi who's worshipping the self which has no form, the akshara, is already such an exalted state that we can only kind of have an idea about it. As you read these, you'll realize how far away we are from these characteristics. So let me just quickly go through the rest of these, just to give you an idea. So I think we were up to, we'll start at 16. Anapekshaha, he doesn't depend on anything. Suchi, he's pure. Daksha, he's skillful in his actions. Gata Vyakta, all anxieties have gone from his heart. He's not worried about what will happen tomorrow. He's not worried whether he'll be successful in some endeavor. He's not anxious about the future. He has no regrets about the past. That's called Gata Vyataha. Sarva Arambha Parityagi. Tyagi means to abandon. Pari means completely. He completely abandons what? Sarva Arambha. All undertakings for the purpose of getting something to make himself more full and more complete. That's called Sarva Arambha Parityagi. Yo Mat Bhakta. This person who's like this, he's Mat Bhakta, my devotee. Sa Me Priyaha. He is very dear to me. The person who has these qualities becomes dear to the Lord. Nache Hrishite Nadveshtati. He neither becomes elated when something good happens, nor does he become dejected when something bad happens. Nasochati. He doesn't grieve anymore. All grief has left him. Nakankshati. He doesn't desire anything for his own fulfillment, for his own benefit. He feels that he's attained all that had to be attained, that he's got everything that has needed to be gotten. It's called kritta kritya. He's done everything that has to be done. He feels that the mission of his life is over. Kritta kritya. Shubha shubha parityagi. He completely gives up all good and all evil. Shubha shubha. He gives up all, this is 17. Shubha shubha parityagi. That bhaktiman, that devotee, yaha, he who is like that, sa me priyaha, he is very dear to me. The word priya doesn't mean dear. Priya means beloved. He is my beloved. That's a better translation. Samaha, he is the same. Shatra mitre, towards the enemy or the friend, he sees them all as his own self. Samaha, samadarshinaha, he sees the same in the enemy and the friend. They're all Atman to him. Samaha shatra mitre che tada mana apamana. When somebody praises him, hey boy, you really gave a good lecture on Vedanta there, boy. Oh, you stink. You don't know what you're talking about. What? What do you mean I don't know what I'm talking about? That's mana apamana. When somebody praises us, we feel, and when somebody criticizes, but this person is samaha. it matters not whether somebody criticizes him or praises him. Funny example. In Naish Karma Siddhi, this book by Sureshwaracharya, the direct disciple of Shankaracharya, he had a disciple, and his disciple was named Sureshwara, who wrote this book, Naish Karma Siddhi. So in that book, he gives the example. He says, before we eat the food, we know that the food is not me. Then I eat the food, and then I think it's me. And then I shit the food out, and I go, oh, that's not me. And then he says, if somebody points to the shit and says, boy, that's disgusting, we don't feel that we've been criticized. But when they point to this and say, that's disgusting, we feel very bad. It's the same food. It's just there, there, or here. Anyway, he's the same in praise and blame. Mana apamana samaha. Shita ushna sukha dukeshu samaha. He's samaha. He's the same. He has equanimity in shita, cold, ushna, heat, sukha, happiness, dukkha, sorrow. Sangha varjitaha, he's varjitaha, he's cast off all sangha. Sangha means attachment. He's not attached to anything, including his own body. He's not even attached to his own ego. That's called asangha, unattached. Sangha varjitaha. Tulya, he's the same. Tulya, equal. What? Ninda stuti, whether he's criticized or praised. Similar to mana apamana. He's the same in contempt and praise. Santushtaha. Tushta means satisfied. San means completely. He's completely content in his own self. He revels in his own self. He takes his happiness in his own self. He finds nothing greater than his own self. There's another verse in the Gita. It says, Atmani eva samtushtaha. He's satisfied in the self alone. Atmani eva ramantaha. He revels in that self alone. Atmani eva stittaha. He's established in that self alone. This is the same idea. Santushtaha, yena kena chit, by whatever comes. Remember when I told you about that sannyasi who's begging for the food? The food comes, santushtaha. If the food doesn't come, santushtaha. Whatever comes or doesn't come, doesn't matter. He's content in his own self. You can imagine people like us trying to try this stuff. Santushta kenachit, with anything. Aniketaha. Now this is a tough word because it actually literally means homelessness. He's without home. But all it really means is not that he doesn't have a home, it's just that he has no attachment to wherever he's staying. That's what anaketaha. Because a wise man can have two wives and live in a home, but have no attachment to the whole thing. That's the real meaning of homelessness. There was a famous German sannyasi, he used to have a good name. His name was Agayananda. Anybody hear of Agayananda? Gaya means house. A means without a house. Ananda means bliss. The bliss of having no house was his name. Agayananda. The bliss of homelessness. Here also, anaketaha. He's not attached to any home. Anaketaha. Stira mati. His mind is stira, firm in his wisdom. he's established in that wisdom about his true self is called Sthiramati. Bhaktiman, that Bhaktiman, this is who a Bhakta is. It's not just crying out to the Lord, help me. That's not the whole of Bhakti. In fact, it's a little baby Bhakti. This is the real Bhakta. Bhaktiman, me priyo naraha. He is a man who is very dear to me. He is beloved by me. So then, at the last verse, the introduction, Shankara concluding this thing, he says, the Lord concludes the list of characteristics begun in verse 12-13 of the worshippers of the imperishable. That's the self. That's the only thing that doesn't perish. It's not in time. That's the akshara. Those worshippers of the imperishable. The renouncers, those are the sannyasis. The people who have the knowledge of the self, that's what's real renunciation. It's not putting on an orange robe. It's not sitting on nails. It has nothing to do with going to a cave. This is the sannyasa that was just described. These sannyasis who have shed all desires and are consecrated to the knowledge of the real. He concludes, Yetu dharmyam amritam idam. This amritam dharmam, this immortal dharma, this blissful dharma, yata uktam, as I've told it to you, Arjuna, just as I've described it to you, yata uktam, pariyupasate, those who worship like this, shraddadanaha, filled with faith, shraddadanaha, matparaha, with me is the supreme. Mat in the Gita means me, myself. With myself is the supreme. Matparaha, bhaktaha, that bhakta, te, they, ativa, very, very, very much. Ativa me priyaha. They are very, very dear to me. That's bhakti. That's the exalted state of a bhakta. So, I'm looking over here because we have a bhakti here. So, just remind me. How did I get onto that? That was because in the 13th chapter, Shankara refers to these verses. So I thought I would go over them with you. And I thought that before we get into... We took the first two shlokas of the 13th chapter so far. We're going to discuss them a little bit more. But before I go into that, I want to share with you a little bit about my personal thing, my spiritual journey. So I think I told you all that in the beginning I met Swami Dayananda, and I spent... 2 years with Swami Dayananda, and he taught me the Bhagavad Gita for 2 years. I studied every chapter, just about, except for chapter one, which nobody studies because it's just the setup for the whole Gita. So he would take chapter 2, chapter 16, chapter 13, chapter 18, and we travel around India studying the Gita. And being a young man, I was 21 at the time, and I wasn't a sannyasi. I came from the hippies in New York, and here I am in India, and I'm now traveling around with a sannyasi, and I'm just like every other Westerner, filled with desires, filled with whatever any other Westerner would be filled with. So usually after 3, 4, 5 months, I'd say, Swamiji, I can't take it anymore. You got to let me go. I got to go find some Westerners. He says, yeah, you go, you go. You come back when you're ready. So I would go, and I would either go to where, I would go to where in those days the Westerners hung out. And that was Goa, South India, the original hippies, 1970, I went to Goa. And also there was a place in the Himalayas that all the freaks were going, and that was called Manali, up in high Himalayas. And if you went there, you'd be able to find Westerners, and you'd be able to maybe have sex. You might find some ganja. You might hear some of your own music. And you'd be with in Goa every night at sundown. They'd make fires, and all of the people would come down, and people had guitars and drums. And it was kind of like... You felt like you were with your own people, because when I was with Swami Dayananda, there was not one Westerner. They were all Indians. I couldn't take it. So I'd go. But after about 2, 3 weeks or 4 weeks, all of a sudden I'd wake up one morning, I realized, what am I doing here? I came to India to get up and never come down. And I'm sitting here with these guys doing the same thing. I could have stayed in New York for this. So immediately I'd go back to Swamiji. And I'd spend another 4, 5, 6 months studying. And then I go, Swamiji, I need a break. So what happened was, after about almost 2 years of this, I was once again in Goa. Same deal. I realize I'm wasting my time, I've lost, I'm off the path, I got to get back to Swami Dayananda. And so I was in Bombay, and I was going to meet Swamiji in Chennai, that's all the way across the continent. And in those days, I had next to no money. In those days, I had no money, but Swamiji would give me like an allowance. He was not only my guru, he was like my father. He gave me my books, my clothes, everything. Swami Dayananda was my life at that time. So I had a little money, and I bought a third class ticket from Mumbai to Chennai, Madras. In those days it was called Madras. Anybody ever travel third class train India? Second. Second, okay. The third class in those days, you get a wooden seat, and there's people sitting on the floor, chickens, children shitting in the aisle, piss. It was horrible. And it would take almost 3 days to get from Mumbai to Madras. It stopped at every single little station. So the deal was, as you're traveling, the train would stop and they'd make an announcement. 15-minute stop, you can go on to the platform, stretch your legs. So at one of these stops, I got off, and there was a guy in the train station who was pushing this thing that was shaped like this, and it had wheels, and he's pushing it, and on both sides there were books. It was a bookseller, and he's pushing the thing. And he passes by me, and just by chance catches me in the eye. There's this little pamphlet, maybe 70, 80 pages. And the name of the pamphlet, it says, Misconceptions About Advaita Vedanta. 5 rupees. I bought the book, and I got back on the train. So I thought this might be interesting, and I start reading the book. And by the time I got to the end of the book, I was absolutely convinced that everything that I had been studying for the last 2 years was wrong. I read it again, and I read it a third time. And every time I read it, I became more convinced that the major ideas that I had been taught from Swami Dayananda were, in fact, there were some problems with it. So by the time I got to Chennai, I was in a tremendous mental state of what to do. So I went to Swamiji. I said, Swamiji, I have to talk to you. He says, okay, you come to my room in the evening. We'll have a discussion. So I came into the room and I said, Swamiji, I just read this book. It says everything you've been telling me is absolutely wrong. He says, what book is that? I said, I don't know. I found it in the train station here. But he says, well, give me one example. I'm not going to read the book. Give me one example. So here's the example. And I'm mentioning this because maybe some of you have heard this teaching, which is that there was this thing called ignorance, which is a synonym for Maya, and it's a power, and it exists right now. It's what's making this whole world appear, in fact. The whole duality is appearing because of this ignorance. And that not only does it exist in the waking state, this power, when you're dreaming, this ignorance is there. And not only that, that power of ignorance, even when you go to deep sleep, that power of ignorance, the Shakti, Avidya Shakti, it was called, is there in deep sleep. That's why we wake up again. If there was no ignorance in deep sleep, you wouldn't wake up. And this is what I had been studying for 2 years, and I believed it, it made sense to me, and I had no reason to question it. But in the book, it said, in deep sleep, there's no ignorance. That we become one with the absolute in deep sleep. Just like the space in the jaw, when the jaw goes, the cup space and the infinite space are one. In that state, the Father is no Father, the Son no Son, the thief no thief, the Veda no Veda. In that state, he has become one with his own nature. That is the Upanishad. The Upanishad says, in deep sleep, we all become one with that non-dual reality. There's no ignorance in deep sleep. I said, Swamiji, the book says in deep sleep there's no ignorance. But you've been saying that there is ignorance in deep sleep. He says, that's ridiculous. How could there be no ignorance in deep sleep? If there was no ignorance in deep sleep, then all you have to do is go to sleep and you'd be liberated. If there was no ignorance in deep sleep, then why do you wake up? Who wrote that book? Yeah. I said, yeah, but Swamiji, it's not him. He's quoting the Upanishads. There's an Upanishad that says, when he sleeps, svapati, svapati. The word sleep in Sanskrit is svapati, he sleeps. And the Upanishad breaks it up. Sva, one's own self, apati, he enters. Sleep means you enter into your own self. And they give the example, just like the lover, when he embraces his beloved and knows neither himself nor anything else, in deep sleep, he's embraced by that all-encompassing reality. And he knows neither himself nor nothing else. He becomes one with Sat. He becomes one with existence. So, I said, Swamiji, it says so clearly there that in deep sleep there's no ignorance. Ah, you're not understanding it correctly. Listen, I've been teaching you for 2 years. If you can't understand this, you're a useless fellow. And why don't you just go to the guy who wrote that book? I said, Swamiji, I don't even know who wrote the book. Well, I have nothing more to say to you. If you can't understand what I'm saying, then I have nothing more to say. I said, but Swamiji, it's not about whether you... I just want to know the truth. He says, then I suggest you go find out who wrote that book. And I left the room. I said, I think I'm going to try that. But at that point, I had no money, zero. And I hitchhiked from Madras because in the back of the book, there was a thing, it said, published by the Adhyatma Prakasha Karyalaya, Tyagarajanagar, Bangalore. So I had an address. So I hitchhike. I took lorries and I get to Bangalore and I show somebody the address. They point me and I finally make it in some house in the suburbs of Bangalore. And I knock on the door. I'm 23 years old now. I had spent 2 years with Dayananda. I'm 23. I had, in those days, I was a brahmachari. He gave me a name. My name is Atma Chaitanya. I got that from Swami Dayananda. I kept that name all these years in terms of my spiritual name because I owe a tremendous amount to Swami Dayananda. He taught me so much about Vedanta. There's no doubt about it. And without him, I couldn't have then done what I did after that. So I owe a tremendous amount to Swami Dayananda. And he was a great Vedantin. He introduced Vedanta to more people than almost any other modern Vedantin. Real Vedanta. He always said, Shankara, Shankara, Shankara. And that was an important thing. So anyway, I knock at the door and this lady comes. And she doesn't speak any English. And she goes like this. And I hold up the book. I go, Swami Satchitanandendra? She goes, Beto, Beto. So I sit down. I don't know what to expect. And the door opens. And this guy comes in, a swami, a sannyasi. He's bent over. He's got this staff. And he's 93 years old when I met him. I'm 23. He's 93. And he comes in and he plops into the chair. Like, oh my God, I came all the way to this. Does he even speak English? He looks at me and in perfect English, he says, how can I help you? I said, Swamiji, I'm a student of Swami Dayananda. I've been studying Vedanta for 2 years. Swamiji says in deep sleep there's ignorance. But in your book, it says there's no ignorance in deep sleep. I've come to you to find out, is there ignorance in deep sleep or not? So he looks at me and he says, how are we going to determine the answer to that question? Should we take a vote? If 20 Swamijis say yes and only 15 say no, we go with the 20? He says, listen, sir, Swami Dayananda's deep sleep and my deep sleep and your deep sleep is exactly the same. Don't think they're different. So no matter what anyone tells you about deep sleep, if it's not in accordance with your own experience, forget it. Check your own experience. Then you'll know the answer. Because if I were to tell you something that's not your experience, why would you believe it anyway? Check your experience. See if in deep sleep there's even a mind. Without a mind, how could there be ignorance or knowledge? See if there's even a mind. Then I said, this Vedanta. Check your own experience, regardless what anyone says. This is an interesting approach. Because I was just accepting that on the authority of the guru, and he said it and made kind of sense, but I had no experience of that. And in fact, everyone's experience is that in deep sleep, there's no ignorance, there's no mind, there's no duality, there's only Brahman. Deep sleep is the non-dual truth. How we were in deep sleep is how we are right now. That is our eternal nature. You only call it sleep from the waking point of view. But in deep sleep, is it deep sleep? How long did you sleep? How long? Oh, I slept about 6 hours, went to bed 12, woke up. In the waking state, you make it that it's an event in the waking time series. But in deep sleep, timeless awareness. It's your eternal nature. It's only when you look at it from the waking you think, I woke up from deep sleep. You didn't wake up. You didn't go to sleep and you didn't wake up, because the self is always awake. That is deep sleep. Then I said, ah, I think there's something here to be learned. Swamiji, can I study with you? He was 93 at the time. He says, I'm old now. He was going blind. He was going deaf. He was incontinent. He had to wear diapers. He could hardly walk. It was the end. And he was working still on 30 manuscripts he had all over the floor. And he says, I'm sorry, I can only meet you on Tuesdays and Thursdays for 1 hour. I said, I'll take it. I'll take it. But I don't have any place to live and I have no money. And it just so happens there was a person in the room who's one of the most wealthy men in all of Bangalore, maybe in all of India. He owned the largest liquor company. It's like Seagram 7. You know Seagram's? No? Beck's beer? Heineken? It was like the owner of Heineken. He had a mansion with Rolls Royces. And he said, I have an abandoned house about two blocks from where Swamiji's staying. And if there's no, I have no electric in there, but there's running water, there's no furniture. If you want to stay there, you can stay there. And if you're really serious, you come to my mansion once a week and I will give you money for any books you need, any cloths that you might need, and I'll help you if you really want to study with Swamiji. I said, okay, great. So I moved into this place, and so I could only see Swamiji twice a week for an hour. So all week I was thinking of questions that I could ask him, so when I come I wouldn't. So I'd have a little notebook filled with questions. And so when I'd come, I'd open the notebook and I'd start and I'd ask him a question and he'd try to answer it. Then I ask him another question. Hours up, namaste, go. Thursday come, I'd have a whole new set of questions. Because I was reading all the books and they were raising lots of questions for me. And I'd ask the questions. And this went on for about 2 months. At the end of 2 months, I came and I opened the book and he said, hey, before you ask me any more questions, I just want to tell you one thing. Vedanta is not questions and answers. If I answer your question to your satisfaction, you know what you're going to get? Intellectual satisfaction. If I give you an answer that you don't like, you know what you're going to get? Intellectual dissatisfaction. But what you need is not intellectual satisfaction. You need spiritual satisfaction. And in order to get that, you don't use the intellect. You have to use the spiritual faculty of the mind. Remember I was talking about this thing? This is where I understood it's not about questions and answers. That will do you no good. You should ask questions. The teacher should give you answers. But until you turn that mind back and see the truth for yourself, no amount of questions and answers are going to suffice. I spent 2 years with that Swamiji. And he taught me many other things, not just that ignorance doesn't exist in deep sleep, but so many other things that most people have never heard of, like you don't need samadhi to get enlightenment. You don't need any mystical state to attain moksha. He taught me that after you get the knowledge of the self, there's nothing left to do and nobody left to do anything. Unlike many teachers who say, even after the knowledge of the self, there's still some things that you have to do. I could go on. I'm not going to. What happened was, I spent 2 years, so now I'm 25 years old. And in those days, I had some crazy ideas. One of them was that this is the temple of God, and medicine is poison. And I'm not going to take any medicine, no matter what. I'm not going to put poison in the temple. So whenever I would get sick in India, and I got sick all the time in India, because I was living on the street, eating street food, I had no shoes, I was getting infections everywhere, living like a crazy kid. And whenever I would get sick, I would fast. And being a young boy with good immune system, I'd get healthy again, and I'd carry on. And one thing that I kept getting was a thing that's called amoebic dysentery. Does anyone know amoebic dysentery? You know dysentery? You know dysentery? That's when you have diarrhea. Well, amoeba. In German, amoeba. I had bad amoeba. And these amoebas, what they do is they're on the food. Somebody goes to the bathroom, they don't wash their hands, and then they make you a salad. You eat the salad, it goes inside you. And these amoebas, they start eating the lining of your intestines. And so when you go to the bathroom, you have blood, and then you know amoeba. So then whenever I saw that, I would start to fast, and after a week, 5 days, 8 days, it would clear up. And I'd go, and then I wouldn't get it for another 8 months or 6 months. So now, at the end of 5 years in India, I got it again, and I was with that old teacher there, and I got the amoebic dysentery. And someone said, you should go take some medicine. I said, no, I'm not taking medicine, I'm fasting. So I started fasting in Bangalore, and I started fasting on like watermelon juice and mangoes and papaya and things like that, a fruit fast. But it was getting worse. So then I went on coconut water and yogurt. It was getting worse. Now it was getting really bad. When I went to India, I weighed 180 pounds. I don't know in kilos. Anybody know pounds, kilos?
90 kilos.
180 pounds. A big, I was built like you. Like this gentleman. So, by the time at the end of the 5 years, I was about 150 pounds. I got thin, but not that thin. And, but now I started fasting, and it was getting worse and worse. And then I decided to go on a water fast. And I went on a water fast for about 2 weeks, and it was getting worse and worse. And I had one Italian friend that came and he saw me. By now I was about 125 pounds, getting really thin. He looks at me, he says, hey man, you got to get to the hospital. This is getting... I says, no, I'm not going to the hospital. If this is my karma, this is my karma. Ho! So he says to me, all right, I'll take you to a naturopathic clinic. You know naturopath? Where they treat you naturally. I said, okay, I'll go to a naturopathic clinic. So I couldn't hardly walk anymore. I was very weak. And I had no money. Oh, by the way, I came to India with a 3-month tourist visa. I was now there 5 years, so totally illegal in India. And all I have is an expired passport. that somehow I kept throughout the years. So I got my expired passport, no money, and he buys a ticket on a train to this little village in the middle of nowhere in Tamil Nadu, and he throws me on the train, and we get down there, and we're in the station, and we say, okay, get your stuff together, and the train is pulling out of the station, and I can't move, and he picks me up, and he throws me onto the platform, and I go rolling onto the platform, I'm all cut up, and there we are in this train station in the middle of nowhere, I can't stand up, and I'm bleeding. And he finds, there's no rickshaws, no nothing, he finds a bullock cart. You know what a bullock cart is? A cart with a bull in the front, and the guy goes like this. He threw me on the back of the bullock cart, and he gave the guy the address, and we pull up Lakshman Sharma's Naturopathic Clinic. And the guy, the owner, the head director, comes out. He sees me laying in the bullock cart. I now weigh about 120 pounds. And he looks at me and says, what's the matter? I'm Uiba. I have amoebic dysentery. And he says, oh, amoebic dysentery? Don't worry. Many foreigners have come here. We can help you. You'll be fine. So my friend put me in this room. And it was just a tiny little room the size of a bathroom. It had in India they have these beds that are made out of rope beds where the rope is. So there's this rope bed. They throw me on the rope bed. My friend says, okay, good luck. He splits. And now I'm in this place laying there. And I haven't eaten now for weeks. But I have to go to the bathroom every 20 minutes. And all I'm passing is blood, and pieces of my intestine are now coming out. And I'm seeing this. And pretty soon after a while, so he says, don't worry, we're going to give you heliotherapy. What's that? You're going to lay in the sun. We're going to give you massage, stomach massage. We're going to give you enema. We'll clean out your intestines. And we're going to put you on a papaya and yogurt fast. You'll be fine. Great. So there I am in the bed, and every 20 minutes I'm going to the bed, and I'm becoming anemic because I'm losing lots of blood. So now I'm becoming anemic and weak. And this is going on. I had my Bhagavad Gita. So all I could do was read the Gita and lay there and hope that I'm going to get better. And what happened was, it got worse and worse. Pretty soon, I couldn't make it myself to the toilet. They had to pick me up. You know, Indian toilet, it's just a hole in the ground. And they would hold me over the hole. And then blood and linings of my intestines, and they put me back in the bed. So then he says, this is not working. We're going to have to put you on a watermelon juice fast. I said, okay. So I do this, and now I'm just drinking watermelon juice for about 3 weeks. I weigh now about 90 pounds.
Half your weight.
Skeleton. I'm like a skeleton now. I'm like a concentration camp guy. This, then the bone pops out, then this. They had a mirror and a scale there. So they were weighing me, and occasionally I couldn't look at myself anymore because I didn't. And then, it's not much of a Vedanta story. A little break from the thing there. So what happens was, I'm getting worse and worse. And he comes in and he says, it's not working. You're going to have to go on a water fast. I said, a water fast? Now? He says, yes, this is what's required. And I began and I went on a water fast. And for 32 days, I drank nothing but Indian water. On the 32nd day, I now weighed 77 pounds. I couldn't move my legs. I had what was called drop feet. I couldn't lift my things up. You know, they were hanging like this. And this whole half of this body had turned blue. And my stomach was on fire. It was burning. I was totally anemic. And I don't know if anybody knows this. What happens is when you die, I was just about to die. When you die from amoeba, dysentery, the amoebas go into your bloodstream and they go into your brain and they start eating the synapses of your brain. And when you finally die, you die in a state of what's called amoebic psychosis. You're hallucinating like crazy. You've lost all touch with reality because your brain is being eaten away. And I was at that stage, sometimes hallucinating, sometimes I thought I was sane and this. And I said, well, that was my karma, but at least I found my guru and I'm content. It was good enough for me. I'm going to die, I know it. And the guy walks in, I'm skeletal, I can't move, I'm anemic. And I looked at him and he looked at me and I said, I want to ask you one question. If I was your son, would you tell me to continue this fast? And for the first time, he started to cry and he looked away. I said, no, no, it's okay. I understand. You did your best. I'm going to die. It's okay. But please, don't let me die thinking about my stomach. I want to think about God. Let my mind go to God. I can't take the pain in my stomach. Please get me some morphine. Get me some opium, heroin, something. He says, this is a naturopathic clinic. We don't have any morphine or opium. I said, then you take me someplace where I can get something so I can die in peace. So the guy says, we don't have what do you want? I said, take me to the American Embassy. So in those days, this is 1975, the people had these old beat up, what was called ambassadors. There's a brand of car in India called Ambassador. They threw me in the back of an old beat up ambassador and they gave me a driver who couldn't speak English. And I was laying on the back seat, going in and out of consciousness, hallucinating. And I remember in the back seat, I looked out the window and I saw a tree. And I said, if I pass out again, this may be the last tree I ever see. I hope that's not the last tree. Because I was sure, I didn't think I was going to, it was a 7-hour drive to the embassy. So I'm on the back seat. And the driver takes, and sure enough, 5:20, we pull into the parking lot of the American Embassy in Madras. Closed, 5 o'clock. But there's one car in the parking lot, and it turns out that it's the director of the embassy, the head of the embassy in Madras. And he walks out, and he comes over to the car. I'm laying in the back. And he looks at me and he says, are you American? That was the question. Are you American? I couldn't talk, nothing. I had my passport and I held up my passport. He disappeared, he ran. Within 5 minutes, there were 2 ambulances. They grabbed me out of the thing, they hooked me up with the IVs, and I was off to the Diplomat Hospital in Madras, where all the diplomats went. All the doctors were trained in the West. It was a super hospital. They called up my parents. Hello, Mrs. Shepperton. We found your son in an extreme state of emaciation. His kidneys aren't functioning. We think he has brain damage. He'll never walk again. We're trying to save his life. We'll call you back. That was the call they got. So anyway, as soon as I got to the hospital, they shot me up with this thing. It's called amoebicide. The drug was called emetine. And they gave me a massive dose of this. And they threw me in a room. I was still hallucinating. I didn't really know where I was, in fact. But I knew something medical, and I had the IVs, and I'm in a room, and I said, boy, I wonder what I look like now. And so they left me in the room. I want to give you a visual of this. I rolled off the bed because I couldn't walk, and I grabbed the thing that had the IV, you know, it's on a, and I pulled myself into the bathroom, and I grabbed the sink, and I pulled up to the mirror, and I looked in the mirror, and I didn't know who it was. It was a skeleton face. I couldn't recognize myself. I said, oh my God, who is that? I said, I'll smile. I know my smile, at least if... And I smiled, and there was this grotesque, you know, oh my God, no. And I went down back to the room. Anyway, to make a long story short, I spent 6 weeks in the hospital, and then the police came and said, Mr. Shepparton, you've been in this country 5 years illegal. You got to go. The doctors came in and said, Mr. Shepparton, you'll never walk again. But if you go back to America with specialists, maybe with a walker or with braces, they'll get you going. If you stay in India, you'll be in a wheelchair for the rest of your life. I said, okay, gotta go. And that was it. They put me on a plane, 24 hours. I was in JFK. My parents were there waiting for me. I had gained 25 pounds in the hospital. I was eating, once the amoebas were gone, I was eating like a pig. And I get, so now I weigh 100 pounds. I thought I was great. And when my parents saw me, it was quite a thing. That anyway, the doctors were wrong. I recovered, young man, so I recovered. That's how I left India. 2 months later, that Swamiji that I had, the old Swamiji, he died. So I never saw him again. But for the rest of my life, I've been studying his books. I've been teaching other people about his understanding of Shankaracharya and Advaita Vedanta. And what happened was, I'm going to continue this. I think it's worth it. You just can hear this. So what happened was, now I'm back in America. I got my health back a little bit. And my father says to me, all right, what are you going to do with your life now? You're 25, you have no money, no house, no career, no education. I left after high school. I'm uneducated. I said, Dad, I want to go back to school. I'm going to get a PhD in philosophy, and I'm going to become a teacher in the university. He said, okay, we'll help you if you can stay with us, but you're going to have to take out student loans, and if you want to do it, you do it yourself. I said, I'll do it. So within 3 months of being back, the new semester started, and somehow some university in New York accepted me. And I got into university, enrolled in an undergraduate Bachelor of Arts course. And I signed up, and the very first class that I attended, the name of the class was called Mysticism and Modern Day Psychology. And the teacher told everybody, sit in a circle, and I want everybody, we're going to go around, you tell what is it that you want in life the most. So everybody was taking their turn and saying, oh, I would like to have this career, or I'm hoping to travel, or I'm hoping... So when it came to me, I said, I want to be happy. I want to be infinitely happy forever. That's all that I want. So the teacher looks at me and says, okay, very good, thank you. So we went around and the class ended. And then when we all walked out, one of the ladies in the class came up to me and said, you know, I want to be infinitely happy forever also. I said, really? Would you like to go to a movie? And that became my wife. We went to the movie, and she took me home, and I never left. And we've been together for 50 years. So, with three children. So, that was it. But, so now, what happened was, so that's 1975. In 1995, 20 years later, I was writing on Vedanta. I got my Bachelor of Arts. I got a Master's in Psychology. And I was on my way to a PhD. But something happened in my life where I figured out how to make a lot of money, a fair amount of money. And I realized I'm making much more money than I'll ever make as a professor. And with this money, I can be free just to study all that I want without having to deal with academia. So I never completed the PhD, and I became what I call a lay scholar. I just used to lay around and read books on Vedanta. That's called the lay scholar. So 1995, there's a book there's a magazine in America that's somewhat famous. I don't think they have it in Germany. It's called Hinduism Today. Yeah? So it's in America. They publish it in Hawaii. And I'm reading the book, and in the back of the book, there's an advertisement. It says, Swami Atmanandendra, the direct disciple of Swami Satchitanandendra, my guru, is giving lecture at Princeton University on the three states of waking, dream, and deep sleep. Wow, who's this guy? Atmanandendra, I never knew that my guru ever even made anyone a sannyasi. So I went to the lecture. And then at the end of the lecture, I went backstage and I said, I have to talk to Swamiji. Tell him that we're guru bhais, that my guru and his guru, I studied with his guru. Go ahead. And so when Swami Atmanandendra heard this, they let me in. And I said, Swamiji, so wonderful to meet you. I didn't know that there was any other sannyasis. Your lecture was wonderful, and I really appreciated it. So he says to me, well, thank you. And do you know, I remember you. I used to be in the back of the room when you would come in with your little book with all the questions. I was in the back listening to those questions. Really? Yeah, I remember you. Atma Chaitanya, right? Oh, Atma Chaitanya, yeah. So he says, I'm in India. I'm living in Mysore. If you ever come to India, please come and visit me. So I thought, we're guru bhais. You know what a guru bhai is? That you're equal. We both have the same guru. What I know, he knows. He has nothing to teach me because we both have the same teacher. And I've studied this for 30 years. What more could he possibly know that I don't know? I know that there's no ignorance in deep sleep. He knows there's no ignorance in deep sleep. I know that after knowledge, nothing has to be done. He knows that after... So we're the same. But I can come visit him just out of kind of a courtesy call. I'm going to leave out some of it. But in 1996, I went to India, and I went to his ashram. It wasn't an ashram. It was just a hut in the middle of a field somewhere, and he was sitting in there. So I come in there, and we begin discussing. And somehow the discussion comes up, and this is Vedanta. The discussion comes up, if you cut a wise man, will he feel it? If you cut a wise man, does he feel it? If you think he feels it, raise your hand. One. Two, three, four. He may feel it. It looks like he would feel it. What is he, a stone? He's gonna feel it, right? So my answer was, yes, he feels it. But he knows that it's not real. The wise man feels the cut just like everyone else. But he knows that it's just Maya. That's the right answer. But the Swamiji says, no, he won't feel it. Swamiji, what do you mean he won't feel it? Of course he's going to feel it. No, he won't feel it. And I kept pressing him on it. And no matter what, he kept saying, the wise man will not feel the cut. And then I thought, oh, this guy doesn't know Vedanta. I'm wasting my time here. He's confused. I said, I better check. And I went to all of the other students of my teachers, SSS, Swami Satchitanandendra, and every one of them said, of course he'll feel it. What do you think? You have to drop dead to be a wise man? One guy says, what do you think? A wise man is like a stone? Yeah, of course he feels it, but he knows the truth of it. So, after going to all the experts, and they all agreed with me that this Swamiji was wrong, one guy, one very famous Swamiji said, that Swamiji is cuckoo. He went like this, cuckoo. That's ridiculous. Shankaracharya, he wrote a book, right? Did he feel any pain when he was walking? Of course he felt it. What kind of nonsense? You go tell that guy he better find a new teacher. So I went back to that Swamiji. I said, Swamiji, I just went to everybody and they all disagree with you. They say the wise man feels the cut. And so you know what he said to me? We're going to take a vote?
Yeah.
Remember that answer? We take a vote? Should we decide this by majority of opinion? The scripture says that the wise man is Brahman. Brahman doesn't feel any cuts. The scripture says the knower of Brahman is Brahman. He is, not metaphorically. When you know it, you'll be it. You won't feel any cuts. You can't cut a wise man. Because the wise man is beyond time, space, and causality. He is the non-dual reality. You can't cut him. It took about a month of arguing with him because I couldn't believe that a wise man is that and he's not this person who's... that my teacher was a wise man and he had all sorts of pains and problems like everyone else. But this teacher was saying, no, the wise man is that. He doesn't feel anything. Brahmavid, Brahmabhavati. The knower of Brahman is Brahman. The one who knows the self will not see anything, hear anything, feel anything, know anything. You can't cut a wise man. So now this was a whole new understanding for me. I've been studying Vedanta for 40 years. And a new idea arose. And I knew that my old understanding was wrong. Because I thought I was a wise man. I knew that I was that infinite witnessing consciousness and that this world was just an appearance. I knew it as strong as anything I could know. I had that firm conviction. And then the Swamiji says, if you have any conviction, it's because you don't know the truth. When you know the truth, you'll have no conviction. The one who believes that I am that doesn't know the truth. When you know the truth, you won't even know that you know the truth. When your ignorance is gone, you won't even know that it's gone. Just like in deep sleep, You don't even know you're in deep sleep. And he showed me in the Bhashya where Shankara says exactly that over and over again. I never quite understood it. So now there was a whole new thing. I was kicked off of my throne of being a jnani. Thank God. What a horrible thing to think that you're a wise man. It's the end of your spiritual journey once you think you know it. It becomes a noose around your neck. Not only that, you know inside your heart of hearts you're just like everyone else. And you have to put on a show for the people that you're something, you know something, you're different than them. You become a total phony hypocrite. You become an actor on a stage. What a horrible way to be. So it was such a wonderful thing to not be a jnani anymore. Now I could be an ignorant person like everyone else and want to study Vedanta as a student again, and to try to understand it properly, finally. So that was my journey from Dayananda to Swami Satchitanandendra, to getting sick, coming back, knowing many things about Vedanta that Swami Dayananda and Swami Chinmayananda and Swami Shivananda and Swami Omkarananda and Swami whoever didn't know. But I still had misconceptions. And this Swamiji, because I never did the sadhana, I never did what the Gita says you have to do. Karma yoga? Are you kidding me? I know I'm the witness. What karma yoga? That's for people who can't understand this. I don't have to do karma yoga. That's for ignorant people. I'm a viveki. I can discriminate the subject from the object. What do I need karma yoga? If you can't do that and you're still identified with this body, then do karma yoga. But not for me. I'm a discriminating person. This type of nonsense puts an end to the whole spiritual journey. Now you think you know. The bondage is knowing. The bondage is being a knower. As long as you know anything, you're bound. That's the profundity of Advaita Vedanta. It's not like what people think, that, oh, you know something and then you're liberated. Nobody ever knew the self. The self doesn't know the self. There's nothing other than the self that could ever know the self. So anyone who thinks, I know the self, is an ignorant man. It's only in ignorance that we talk about knowing the self. But in reality, there's no knower, there's no knowing, and there's nothing known. That's called Advaita. That's who you are. You are that. You don't have to know it. You can't know it. You will never know it. Why? Because you are it. The very desire to know it has to go. The more you try to know it, the better it's hidden. This guy that wants to know it, when Ramana Maharshi said, I'm not space, I'm not the body, I'm not the senses, I'm not the mind, I'm not the ego. And then he said, and then I realized. And then I realized. Who realized? If he got rid of the ego, who realized? And then I realized I was that infinite immortal awareness. That guy that wants to know, that thinks it knows, that has been trying to know, that guru, that teacher, has to get rid of him. The very one who wants to know has to go, because you are that. You don't have to know it. You are it. The very desire to know it keeps us in ignorance. So no matter what we negate, no matter how much we negate trying to know the self, you'll never know it. Only the teacher, in the very end, has to negate the guy that wants to know it. Everybody, let's take a break. 10-minute break.
Could we have 15?
15-minute break, yeah, sure.